Wizardry by Consent by Sixth Light. Chapter 4. Managing Expectations. Thomas is in the coach house, checking his email correspondence and devoting as little time as he can achieve to wondering how he was going to make things right with Grant. Easier when he's got two of the apprentices also in the room doing tasks that require the use of computers, when his mobile phone rings. He feels the unaccustomed bite of nerves as he checks who the caller is. It's the commissioner's office. Something to do with Tyburn's forced retreat, undoubtedly. He steps outside onto the top of the spiral staircase to answer it. The commissioner's PA tells him he's wanted for a meeting this afternoon, if he's available, which, of course, he will be. New case? Asks Mal. She's due at the hospital this afternoon for a check-up and hoping to be giving a clean bill of health. Some experience with these things suggests to Thomas she is over-hopeful. But it never helps to say this before the doctors have voiced their opinion. No, he says, meeting with the commissioner this afternoon. Is that bad? She asks doubtfully. Matt has stopped typing and turned to look at him. I shouldn't think it's anything to worry about, Thomas says. More likely things being put to bed. Tyburn won't take defeat easily, and likely will come back for another round in a few months, especially now she's seen an angle of attack, but she won't go against her mother directly. This represents, Thomas hopes, breathing room. And who knows, if Grant gets his way, things will be changing. They'll have to see. He needs to talk to Grant about that, figure out how and if they can carry through on what he said, but he needs a day or two to work out how, what to say, where to start. I understand your training program is going well, is the first thing the commissioner says, as Thomas is sitting down after handshakes and pleasantries. Probably a good sign that he's been offered a seat. Yes, I think so, ma'am, Thomas says. I wondered how it would go with four of them, but they seem to offer each other reinforcement. They're all progressing with the commissioner waves her hand delicately. The magic, as you might hope. It's hard to make direct comparisons. It's a very different situation from my own training, and the only time we tried on the job training in an organised way before, it was under a great deal of pressure, and it didn't go well. But yes, they're all very dedicated. Which isn't to say there aren't obvious differences in their skill sets. Abigail is particularly good with ghosts for some reason, whereas Mal is undoubtedly the fastest to master any given former. But they would all have been considered, had they been students in Thomas's day, to have the potential to be wizards of the first rank. Had any of them been likely to become wizards at all? He wonders, not for the first time, how on earth Grant spotted that in all of them. Good. That's excellent to hear, says the commissioner, still holding firm on the 10 years thing. To achieve full mastery, undoubtedly, Thomas says. A little more or less, maybe, but nothing significant. There are no shortcuts with this art. The commissioner's brow wrinkles just a touch. And I understand that there have been some steps made towards greater community engagement as well. Commander Grant has made a number of helpful suggestions in that regard. Thomas isn't sure exactly what she's heard about yesterday and feels it might be best not to encourage deeper inquiry into the whole thing if she hasn't. Yes, says the commissioner. I know you're aware there has been some pressure to reopen the Berwick Street inquiry, considering the relationship of those events to your latest case. I think you'll be pleased to know that the pressure seems to have evaporated, rather suddenly. Probably for the best, all things considered. Community engagement, ma'am, says Thomas, which is probably unwise and yet somehow irresistible. Indeed, she says. Nevertheless, oh, that isn't good. Nevertheless, she goes on, there have been a number of questions raised about the suitability of continuing your unit with its current structure. Thomas doesn't have a response to this, knows it must show on his face. You can't be that surprised, Inspector, she says with some irritation. I told you as much when you came to complain to me about Commander Grant a few months back. He wasn't the only one interested in your unit. He was just the only one who'd got into direct contact with you. May I ask who these other people raising questions are, ma'am? From the Home Office and the Mayor's Office for Policing and Crime, she says. Connections of Cecilia Tyburn, I believe, and I think they both know Charles Breeden, which explains... You should consider the source very carefully, then, Thomas interrupts her, unquestionably and unpreventably rude. Breeden was a little crocodile. These men probably are as well, or linked to them. He knew Tyburn had been looking them up. He should have looked harder into where they'd ended up, all Wheatcroft students. Not just whether they'd continue to practice magic or not, but who they'd become. "I am aware of your opinions in that regard," the Commissioner says coldly. "Nevertheless, that doesn't affect the basic validity of what has been said. The folly has existed within the Met in its present form, that is, you, for 80 years. It's become obvious that's insufficient to the extent of the problems it exists to deal with. And while you've taken steps to address that, unwillingly as far as I can tell, more wizards is not a solution in and of itself. A discussion needs to be had about how you operate, the extent of the independence of your operation, and, I hate to say it, but it must be said, how long you intend to remain in your job. I know the usual response is, until they carry me away in a box, but for you, I don't think that's an answer this organisation is equipped to deal with." She smiles sympathetically, like she really does dislike saying it, but it's the last bit that really knocks the wind out of Thomas's sails. He remembers that conversation with Tyburn. How long are you going to keep pretending? He hadn't thought. It had just been another of her gambits, surely. "That sort of decision," he forces himself to say slowly, "doesn't stop with you, ma'am, as I'm sure you're aware." "I'm very aware," she says, "which is why a meeting has been called, and not by me. I believe the Home Secretary intends to be there, the Mayor as well. Nothing's been decided, but if you have opinions about the future of your organisation, then I suggest you prepare yourself to offer them. And, a word to the wise, this is the way we did it for 2 centuries, isn't going to cut it." "Ma'am," Thomas says, "I see. Has a date been set?" "Monday." "3 days." "If I may ask, to what extent have Commander Grant's view on the folly contributed to this discussion?" "A great deal," she says. "He was the first person to point some of this out. This is taking place well above his level, though." "I see," Thomas says again. "If that's all, ma'am." "It is." He stands up. "Inspector Nightingale," she says, "nothing has been decided. I don't personally think you do a bad job. I think you do a very good one under conditions that have been, from what I understand, sometimes difficult. I think you're genuinely trying to make sure the job keeps getting done. That isn't a question. The question is whether that can be enough." His first instinct is to hunt down Grant and demand to know whether this is his doing. But even if Grant is in his office and available to talk, it's not the sort of discussion he wants to have at New Scotland Yard. He deliberately makes himself leave the building with, not suspicious, but steady speed. His second instinct is to find a fight he actually knows how to deal with. But he doesn't have any messages on his phone, so there's likely been no new cases in the 2 hours he's been away from the folly, and anyway, he doesn't have time right now for that. His third instinct, which is less an instinct and more a thought, is to find out whether this is all Tyburn's doing in a roundabout way, so he calls Beverly Brooke. "This better be quick," she says. "I've got patrol in half an hour." "I thought you were all sorted out yesterday. Mum told Ty to back off, and Oxley liked what Peter said enough to agree. Like I said, she's not going to forgive you, but she'll hold off for now." "Then why am I being called to a meeting with anybody with any sort of supervisory power over me on Monday to discuss the folly's direction?" "I don't know," says Beverly Brooke. "My best guess? Ty's been talking to a lot of people, stirring things up for months now. Just because she stopped doesn't mean stuff's going to get unstirred. This isn't a problem of our world. It's politics. You know, the regular sort." "My favourite thing," Thomas says, not disguising the sarcasm. "You didn't mention this before." "You didn't ask," she says. "And you're the Nightingale. You're supposed to know this stuff without me or anybody having to hold your hand. Talk to Peter. He did ask questions." "I don't. I've got to go. Some of us have our own jobs to do." She hangs up. One of the useful things about trying to track down people high enough up in the food chain is that their schedule is not just known to them, if you know who to ask. Thomas calls Grant's office, meaning his PA, and inquires if he's in. He's too professional to give any details, but lets Thomas know that the Commander Grant is in meetings until 6, but something can probably be arranged next week. Thomas thanks him and says he'll call back. It means Grant will be forewarned, but that might not be a bad thing. It gives him about 3 hours to figure out what he wants to say. He still doesn't know. If some of this is Grant's idea, he thinks he's right, obviously. But then why bother intervening with Mother Thames at all? The apprentices want to know what his meeting with the commissioner was about, of course. It's Abigail who actually asks at dinner. Tyburn has apparently backed off, he tells them. I don't expect any trouble from that front for a while. Stephen says she's furious, says Abigail. Stephen? Macalister Thames? Volunteers Annie with a hesitant sideways glance at Abigail. I'm not surprised, Thomas says, and does not ask why Abigail and Tyburn's eldest son are in communication. He suspects he doesn't want to know the answer. He doesn't tell them about the commissioner or the meeting. Not yet. There's time. He knocks on Grant's door at about 8 o'clock. He got into the building by the simple expedient of tailing somebody in, his suit and general appearance doing the job. Hopefully Grant's not still at the office, or out, or entertaining anybody. It's a risk he's going to have to take. Grant opens the door. He's still in his uniform trousers and shirt, but the tie and jacket are gone. There's a smudge of something, possibly flour, pale and starkly contrasted against his skin on his right cheekbone. Thomas tries to remember whether he's angry or not. It's all a bit of a mess. Okay, Grant says. You were not who I was expecting. Were you expecting somebody? Not in particular, Grant says. They stare at each other for a few moments. I just need to know, Thomas starts wearily at the same time as Grant says. Fine, okay, come in. They stare at each other some more. Grant steps aside. Thomas enters his flat for the second time. It's messier than it was then. Grant's obviously been cooking. Something's in the oven. He's holding a tea towel. There's a half-drunk bottle of Red Stripe on the kitchen bench. I don't mean to interrupt your dinner, Thomas says. Then you've got about... Grant pulls out his mobile phone, squints at it. 25 minutes. This morning I thought I owed you an apology, says Thomas. You do. Grant is blunt. I was just expecting it to take at least a week before you came to that conclusion. What changed your mind between now and then? Give me some credit, Thomas says. I came to that conclusion about 2 minutes after you walked off. Abigail was quite distressed you didn't let her drive you back. Only because she thinks I might hold it against her, which I won't. 2 minutes, really? I didn't express myself well. I know what you were trying to do. That doesn't sound much like an apology, I've got to say. I'm sorry, Thomas says. But what you did, it wasn't yours to do, and I couldn't... I think we had this conversation, Inspector, Grant says, deadly calm. You do not, in any point of fact, get to tell me what to do. Thomas is suddenly teetering on the edge of a precipice he hadn't recognised until too late, lulled by the domesticity of the setting and the flower on Grant's face. I didn't ask you to do any of this. You wouldn't have, would you? And no, of course not. The way Grant sees the folly, sees Thomas, sees his place in the Met, is not the way Thomas would ever have thought to see himself. The idea of asking someone above him to go to the court of the Goddess of the River would felt like an abdication of his responsibilities in the most fundamental way. Look, here's the thing I've learned, Grant goes on, apparently reading something from Thomas's face. I can't know everything you know about your job, and it would be stupid of me to try, because all that would equip me for is doing your job. But I know enough by now to know the scope of what you do, and I know what my job is, which is to make sure everybody in the Met can keep doing their jobs, and everybody in the Met includes you. Thomas thinks about saying something. Doesn't. You know this, Grant says. He tosses the tea towel at the bench, folds his arms. You know it because you're perfectly happy to let the forensics team do their jobs, or the constables, your apprentices, chase up leads, or fraud hunt down financial details, or whatever. But apparently, the moment someone above you tries to take the least bit of responsibility off your shoulders, that's what? Too much? The city's only safe if you're the only thing standing between it and magical chaos. That's the deal, Inspector, for those of us who get to tell you what to do. We get to take the fall if it goes wrong. I know you know that for your apprentices. You need to know it for yourself. What you did, Thomas manages, it was dangerous. Mama Thames isn't stupid. Grant says dryly, and Lady Ty still thinks I might be useful one day, even if she's angry now. I don't think it was a danger of anything more than humiliation. I don't, Thomas says, how you see this working, I'm not sure anybody else does. The job's the job, says Grant. Thomas can hear the capital letters. You don't get to pick and choose which bits of it you want to exist. I don't care how the rest of the Met thinks of it. It's been a very difficult week. is Thomas's sole and rather pitiful excuse for what he does next. That, and it's just that he doesn't quite know how else to say, "Where have you been? Why did you only show up now?" Kissing Grant probably doesn't convey that adequately, come to think of it. If Thomas had thought about this, and he's not admitting he has, but hypothetically, he would have thought that he and Grant would crash into each other like they had the first time, the sort of hot, quick thing that flares out and can be forgotten the next day. Instead, Grant kisses him back almost gently, almost seriously, and all of a sudden it feels like something fragile. Thomas is tired of being broken, doesn't want to break anything else, and puts both his hands on Grant like mapping the territory slowly will ensure a successful campaign. Damn it, he doesn't want this to be a war. Grant pulls him in closer and he goes unprotestingly. It's Grant who stops first all the same, deliberately relaxes his hands, rubs his thumbs soothingly where he was clutching as if to soothe away invisible marks. This isn't going to help. Distractions rarely do, says Thomas. You're not a distraction. Grant's eyes are wide and dark. God, Thomas wouldn't mind being a distraction right now. We need to stop meeting like this, he says in lieu of anything more serious. It works. Grant laughs. You're not wrong. He takes a breath, lifts his hands away. Thomas steps back, though, not far. He still hasn't managed to. This is going all wrong. What I came to say is, he says, the commissioner called me in today. Tyburn's been forced to relent for now. What she set in motion is still going. I have a meeting on Monday with a few people, including the Home Secretary, to, and I quote, discuss the Follies' future direction. It was implied you had something to do with it, although the commissioner did say it was above your pay grade. I want to know if that's true. You think I set you up? I don't know what you want. Thomas thinks about this. Most of what you want. Yeah, apparently, says Grant incredulously. They're still not very far apart. The Home Secretary? The Home Office is ultimately responsible for the folly. Right, I knew that. I guess that explains why you weren't sure whether I deserved an apology or not. I'm sorry, Thomas says again. Thank you. Want a beer? Grant asks. Thomas blinks. He has to think about this. Certainly. So, Grant says, once beer has been provided, tell me what the commissioner said. Tell me exactly what she said. They've sat down at Grant's small dining table. The kitchen area still feels dangerous to Thomas. He keeps making terrible decisions while standing there. Thomas relays the details as best as he can remember them. Grant groans. You don't need me to tell you this, but you're in so much trouble, and I think I know why. Do go on, Thomas says. Tyburn's been talking to a whole lot of people about the folly, Grant says. People who already know about magic. Turns out there's more of them than you think, and they all seem to have gone to university with Charles Breeden and the little crocodiles. I hear that's what they call themselves. I don't know exactly what her plan was, because I made her cautious enough to back off a long time before she told me much of it. Not that I'm sorry about that, but it went something like this. Get rid of you. Not like that. I mean, shuffle you off to retirement or whatever. Shut down the folly. Establish some sort of consultancy for magical cases. Public-private partnership. Candidates for the worst three words in the English language, by the way. Overseen by her, of course, to give the community a stake. And then, well, there's all these Oxford graduates floating around who know something about magic, aren't they? Who never did anything illegal, at least not that they've been caught at. And there was no way to get your opinion on it reasonably because you were, and I also quote, blinkered by your past experiences. Thomas had put some of it together, but this is, it goes beyond what he'd figured out. Breeden was one of the people she was in touch with, I think so. I think that's why he ended up in the alley. He was looking for Miller, because Miller was an eyewitness for Berwick Street, and that was the most fail-safe way to get rid of you, since old age clearly wasn't doing the trick. Thomas props his elbows on the table, runs his fingers through his hair, lets himself sag. And how long exactly have you known about this plan? He looks up at Grant, who looks down. A while. I told you, remember, not even that long ago, that you weren't the only alternative. Withholding judgment, you said. Grant grimaces. I use my long words when I'm tired, and I seem to remember being that close to passing out in Molly's kitchen. She wouldn't have been impressed. She wouldn't have. You came to a conclusion, I take it. Yeah, Grant says, looking up and meeting his eyes. I did. The way she wanted to do things, it wasn't going to work. The way you were doing things, it wasn't going to keep working. But you know that. You were the kind of person who would know that. That was enough. But I spent a while asking questions first. And I don't think this is just the result of that. But it's a contributing factor. There's no mum attempts to intervene in this. It's got too many people. Your only choice is to ride it out. Then I'd better start marshalling my arguments, Thomas says, standing. He hasn't even drunk a quarter of the beer. And I believe your dinner's about to be ready. Thomas, Grant says deliberately, looking up at him. The meeting's Monday, right? Yes. Do you want... Grant gropes for a word. Help? A loud, instrumental theme Thomas vaguely recognises but can't identify begins to sound. Grant jumps and shoves his hand in his pocket. It's his phone alarm. Thank you, sir, Thomas says. No. He sees himself out before Grant can respond. Thomas has had to give plenty of reports over the years, verbal and written. The point is to convey the facts of the matter, of course, but in a way your audience is going to hear and understand. There's never, though, been anything quite like this. Before the war, before Ettersburg, he'd been brought up into a system whose existence far predated and extended beyond him. Even the way he'd been regarded, that slightly ridiculous sobriquet he'd gained at Casterbrook, the Nightingale. He'd never been that high in the chain of command, for good reason. His best work was done on the ground. He'd gone where he was sent and, for the most part, done what he was told. There'd never been any question of change, except for those tense years leading up to Ettersburg, when it was only a question of if they could find more men and how quickly, or if there had been, it hadn't filtered down to Thomas. Afterwards, when the agreements had had to be remade, when most of his colleagues were dead and the rest were retiring or anticipating doing so, he'd still been operating in a half-fugue state. It had been agreed that he would handle any magical questions for the Met, or the nation if necessary. He'd been handed the remaining administrative functions, the Folly, Casterbrook, the trust that funded them. And then, or so it seemed at this late date, everybody had promptly vanished. Only the younger ones were left, and they'd all been junior to him anyway. But at no point had there ever been a question of not continuing, not really, still less of change. The closest he'd got had been the inquiry into Berwick Street, and even that had been something he was more familiar with, defence of his actions in, well, action. Had he made the right decisions in the moment? Could deaths have been prevented? Were there lessons to be learned? They'd concluded that he had, and they probably couldn't have been, and the lesson was that he couldn't be expected to be the only wizard in Britain any longer, and when he'd asked for permission to take an apprentice, more strongly, he'd been refused. Told that under the circumstances, more magic didn't seem the answer. His lengthy investigation into the rest of Wheatcroft's little crocodiles had been not in part intended to support the argument that he needed backup, a potential replacement. He hadn't found anything conclusive, and eventually he'd let it go. It wasn't as if he'd had a suitable candidate lined up. Nobody wanted their constables to spend too much time talking to him. He had thought it was safe, though. Thought that at least those above him had been convinced of the problem with changing things, but the French Academy had been reorganised out of existence in the 60s, hadn't they? And most of the other continental powers had had new structures. The Germans hadn't even started scraping anything back together until after the fall of the Wall, as far as he was aware. And he still wasn't aware of much. The point at which he'd thought it useful and necessary to start seeking out those connections, around the time Varvara Tamonina had stumbled out of hiding, had been almost the same point that Britain had cut herself off from the continent again. This time not with fog or war, but basic diplomatic ineptitude. He suspects, knows, based on some of the things Varvara had eventually told him, that some of those foreign agencies might even have known more about what was going on in London in the 60s and 70s. The Soho Club, the first faceless magician, if there had indeed been two of them, than he had. That's an indictment of his own performance, if ever there was one. He wonders if it's going to come up on Monday. But this, making an argument for what? The continued existence of a Folly, that damnable thing about Tyburn's whole consultant scheme, apart from the fact that she'd found it palatable to go to Wheatcroft's student at all, is that it isn't too far removed from how the Folly had helped the Met before the war. They'd been wizards in every walk of life. Tom's himself in the Foreign Office, others at universities and in other areas of public service. Some had been serving police officers, but largely they'd been consulted when needed. Thomas's own existence within the Met is an accident of history. That's half the reason the rest of the Met looks sideways at him when they remember to use his services at all. The apprentices are all constables. But maybe they think that half-trained, not that they were even that at this stage, would be good enough. Maybe they want to disperse them again, make them proper police officers, their magic only a quirk to be overlooked. The only answer he has for that is that they aren't ready, and the question then will be, what if they were? What then? The other question, the question of his own continued presence, continued youth, well, extended middle age, no need to gild it, he equally doesn't have an answer for. He doesn't have any intention of retiring. He doesn't know what else he'd do. But he's clearly outrun the Met's institutional tolerance for that sort of phenomenon, and it isn't as if he could pledge to start ageing again. He wouldn't know how. And Grant, having known some of it, withheld that information, all the while acting like he wanted to help Thomas, like he might want Thomas. He doesn't know where to start with that. Still doesn't know exactly what he wants, could want. He goes to bed that night without any answers. They don't have an urgent case, and it's the weekend, which means lessons are off the table. Thomas does appreciate the value of rest. So aside from one of them staying on call, and of course practice, which is an everyday requirement, the apprentices aren't guaranteed to be around. Thomas tells them about the meeting scheduled for Monday over breakfast on Saturday. It won't make the meal go down any better, but that really can't be helped. The Home Secretary is responsible for the folly, directly, says Annie wide-eyed. Up the chain from the Commissioner, but yes, Thomas says. Matt has paused midway through a bite of toast. It's quite disconcerting. Abigail narrows her eyes thoughtfully. I thought you said Mama Thames told Tyburn to back off. This is nothing to do with Tyburn, Thomas says. He's very aware of Molly hovering in the doorway. Or, to put it better, it's not directly to do with Tyburn. She just set things in motion. On a scale of 1 to us getting shipped back to the units we came from on Tuesday, said Mal, how bad is it? Thomas has to think about this idiosyncratic scale. 5? Well, says Matt, who's finally put his toast down, you can't trust the English to run anything properly, can you? Typical. Thank you, Matt, Thomas says. Oh, it's okay, sir, he says. I didn't mean you. As they're getting up, Abigail keeps looking at him like she wants to ask a question. But when he prompts her directly, she shakes her head. No, nothing. Just nothing. Is there anything we can help with? Annie wants to know. Research or something? I'll let you know if there is, Thomas promises. Anything at all, she says again. Hold on, not anything. I still can't run anywhere fast, says Mal, waving the cane she's been told to use. She doesn't use it half as often as she should. I don't think this is the sort of problem that can be solved by running, Thomas says to her. I've got it, Annie says. We all run across the border and ask for asylum. I'll sponsor you and all. And leave London? Abigail pokes her head back in. Fucking hell, it's not that bad. Speak for yourself, says Matt. There's other perfectly good cities, you know. I keep getting told that, says Abigail, but no one ever gives me any proof. Thomas does his best thinking with a pen and paper, typing his for finished copies, and retreats to the magical library to do so. The apprentices don't go in there unless they're looking for him. Molly appears with a pot of coffee around mid-morning. Normally, she disapproves strongly of consuming anything in the libraries. It's an ongoing battle with the apprentices. Thomas doesn't mind, as long as they're careful. He wonders what would happen to her if... It's one of the reasons he can't go anywhere. Was his reason 60 years ago, when everybody wondered why he stayed in the folly with its strictly metaphorical ghosts? Could he convince anybody that she genuinely can't leave it? Would they care? She reads over his shoulder while he's pouring coffee. She must be anxious, though that's never easy to tell with Molly. I'll get this sorted out, he says. You don't need to worry. The best thing he can do, he's fairly certain, is to remind them of what the folly has done. All the things that have been prevented, smoothed over, put quietly to bed, that Mother and Father Thames are at peace with each other, that things are working, by and large, and that now he has apprentices, it's going to be easier. He thinks about everything Grant said about community engagement and all the rest of it. He needs to remind them that it goes beyond the folly, of the people he works with in other parts of the Met, Inspector Kumar in the BTP, Abdul at UCH, the archives at the Bodleian, Beverly Brooke coming to ask about Grant, Vavra Tamonina on the fringes of the Demimonde, obliging enough if he approaches her, even if she doesn't tell him everything. that he's not alone here doing this. All the time, the commissioner's voice is saying to him, the question is whether that can be enough. They know what he does, and apparently it isn't enough. How can he explain that it is? Is it? He doesn't work on it all weekend, makes himself take breaks, go for a walk, put the cricket on the wireless. The apprentices come and go, check up on him and try to pretend they're not. Molly hovers, but not incessantly. He thinks half a dozen times about Grant's offer of help, doesn't call him. He has to do this. Grant's the cause of half this problem, not its solution. He takes notes, rearranges them, types them up, keeps looking for the magic phrase that's going to solve this, the incantation that will explain why the folly doesn't need fixing. He hasn't found it yet. That's all right. He's always been better at thinking on his feet. He's interrupted on Sunday afternoon by Abigail and Annie, asking him to come out to the coach house. Is this work related? He's cautious enough to ask. Totally, says Abigail. Cross my heart. Peter, Commander Grant, asked us to show you something, says Abigail, wants to get out there. She holds up a laptop computer. Yes, Abigail, I know what that is, Thomas says, trying for minimal sarcasm. We didn't think you didn't, Annie reassures him hastily. Thomas pretends not to notice Abigail making a hand-rocking gesture of uncertainty at the edge of his line of sight. He wanted us to explain to you about PowerPoint, Abigail goes on. It's Keynote, it's a Mac, says Annie. Whatever, it's the same thing, returns Abigail. Thomas's limited experience of computers suggests that this is probably not true, but as he is somewhat unsure of the difference, he doesn't say so. I mean, sir, you must have sat through plenty of presentations by now. This stuff's been around for 40 years. Sat through? Stood through, occasionally slept through at the back of the room. Annie bites back a smile. Would you mind explaining exactly what it is you're supposed to be showing me? Abigail puts down the laptop, flips it open, pulls out a small black device. Thomas recognises it as a laser pointer. You've seen them, but you haven't given one, right? They're generally a distraction to the actual point people are trying to make. Well, you're not wrong, Annie offers. But Commander Grant asked us to make sure you knew how to go through one just in case. So if you don't mind, sir, in case of what? He didn't say, Annie says doubtfully. I don't know, but I'd be worried if I were you. He's got an idea in his head, says Abigail. Here, take this. Grant arrives just before 8 p.m. in jeans, a nondescript dark blue hooded sweatshirt and carrying a USB drive like it's the crown jewels. Your mum would have a fit if she knew you were at work in jeans, says Abigail. Isn't it lucky for all of us, particularly you, Constable, that I'm an adult and she's never going to find out, says Grant. He looks about 10 years younger, maybe more than that. You'd be amazed how easy it is to get overlooked dressed like this. Yeah, until someone stops you and you have to show them your warrant card, Abigail says gloomily. Thomas doesn't find this terribly likely, neither Abigail nor Grant being that suspicious, but Grant just says, well, they'd be letting the side down if they didn't stop nondescript black guys in hoodies, wouldn't they? And Abigail gives a half-amused hmm in agreement, so clearly he's underestimating the odds. Anyway, it's done, Grant goes on. Where's the laptop? What's done? Thomas has to ask. The presentation you're going to give the commissioner tomorrow, says Grant. No, says Thomas. Would you give us a moment, Abigail? Grant asks politely. Abigail flees. She's a smart girl. No, Thomas says again. I don't... Listen. Grant plugs the drive into the computer. Multiple people have just spent a lot of time getting this together, including, but not limited to me, Molly, and the goddess of Beverly Brook. So, yeah, actually, Inspector, you are. Why? Because, Grant says, the only way to win this is to beat them at their own game. Tyburn's been shut down for now, but she's successfully sold you as a washed-up relic of a dead era, who's at best struggling with and at worst actively damaging to the modern Met's goals. You need to prove you're not, and you can't do that with a stiff upper lip or a good speech. Beverly Brook, you said. She's willing to be convinced, and she knows things about the Demimonde you don't. Grant looks up. He's opened a file. I know you said you didn't want help. Trouble is, the consequences of this go beyond you. It's not about what you want, not anymore. Most of what I do is trying to persuade people about things. We can change it, we can make it right for you, whatever. But how you need to say it for the audience you've got, that's what I know. Let me give that to you. He swallows. Look, I know you probably think I haven't been straight with you, and I guess I haven't. But I was still making up my mind. But it's made up. I told you that. And I'm not letting you go down because you're angry with me. Now, will you sit down and go through this with me, please? Thomas sits down. Dressed like this, Grant looks softer around the edges, and he knows it's its own sort of message coming here like this, like they're friends, like he can afford to not be Commander Grant within the walls of Thomas's home, like that's why he's doing this. He wants to say, I owe you for this. But if he starts, he'll never stop. Obligation doesn't have to be magical. And there really aren't even, as far as he can tell, any strings attached. Personal or political, just Grant's view of the right thing to do. God, he can't deserve this. 10 minutes later, he's thinking the same thing, but in precisely the opposite way. I'm not saying prioritising public involvement, he exclaims as he moves forward through the slides. For God's sake! Thomas, Grant says grimly, arms folded like he's trying to keep them prisoner. You will go in there and you will say prioritising public involvement and managing expectations and, so God help me, going forward if I have to make it a direct fucking order. Sir, Thomas says, because what else can you say to that? Grant relaxes, fractionally. Thank you. It goes more smoothly after that. Grant had meant what he said about how you need to say it. Is most focused on making sure Thomas is offering words that will be understood and making absolutely sure he understands the technical details of operating the device. I'm not sure what you think is going to happen, Thomas says. Magic and electronics aren't exactly compatible, Grant points out. Yes, and if you think I'm planning on bringing magic into this at any stage, except when I'm strictly required to mention it, I know how this audience is going to feel about it. Fine, I know, but... Grant shuts the laptops. There's a great word in German, Vorführeffekt. Can't you just say demonstration effect in English? Yeah, but it sounds better. Anyway, technically this isn't a demo, but under the circumstance, it means that any time you're trying to show off something new, it goes wrong. I, says Thomas, am somewhat of the opposite of a new thing in this context. I just want this to go right, Grant says quietly. I was trying to make your unit better, make things work, not get you fired isn't right. Put aside. No plan survives first contact with the enemy, Thomas offers. Grant looks at him sideways, a smile playing on his lips. Question is, who's the enemy? There isn't one, really. That's the tricky part about this type of conflict. No victories, you just minimise your losses. Only holds if you think you're responsible to the whole organisation, Grant says, or the whole city, or whatever. I don't think you know how to be responsible to anything less. Grant shakes his head. You've got to stop looking at me like that. It's going to go to my head. Like what? Asks Thomas, but he thinks he knows. Like, Grant says, like I can do magic. He knows from Grant that the meeting is going to be in one of the meeting rooms at New Scotland Yard, not the Commissioner's office, even though the message telling him that doesn't arrive until Monday morning, a couple of hours before he's due there. There's a room booking system, Grant has explained. I had my PA check who had what for Monday. Is that technically a legitimate use of resources? I could have needed to have a meeting with somebody, Grant had said in faux innocent tones. It's still police business. Anyway, I've had to fill him in with some of it. He was getting a bit suspicious, especially when I was still meeting with Tyburn. I think for a while there was a rumour I was liaising with some big organised crime operation. All that sneaking around. Not an entirely ludicrous rumour, of course. Grant has spent a few years in intelligence. Anyway, Grant had said, there's nobody in there before your meeting, so make sure you get in early and set up. I bet it'll catch him off guard. I'm not sure that's a good thing at this stage. I think they're as lulled into a false sense of security as you're likely to want. More than a touch of irony there. By 11 a.m, he's got everything ready to go. He's not sorry in the end about the lesson he'd got from his apprentices on how to use the computer for this. Better to be safe than sorry. The Commissioner knows he's early, of course. That information would have been conveyed when he signed into the building, and so doesn't look surprised to find him when she enters the room. The others do, or perhaps it's the computer. They're all carrying tablets, so really, he doesn't see why it should be such a surprise. It's not as if he still insists on using a typewriter or the like. He's lived with computers longer than any of them have, technically speaking. There's handshaking and introductions and reintroductions. He's never met this Home Secretary. And tea and coffee are brought in, and then the knives come out. Metaphorically speaking, of course. Nobody's tried to stab Thomas literally for, must be at least half a century. I told Inspector Nightingale, said the Commissioner, that this meeting would be to discuss the operation of the Folly, the Special Assessment Unit, that is, within the Met. Yes, says the Home Secretary. I think first we should offer Inspector Nightingale the chance to describe how he sees the current purpose of his unit, and how effectively he feels it's functioning. Thank you, says Thomas, before anybody else can speak. I have some slides. Is that all right? They all look at each other, clearly not sure where this is going, and by silent and common consent the Commissioner says, certainly, Inspector. It's all set up, so all Thomas has to do is pull out the clicker Grant had lent him and begin. The Folly is something of an anomaly within the modern Metropolitan Police Service, he says. His words, not Grant's. It was founded in the mid-18th century by Sir Isaac Newton to encourage the systematisation of the practice of magic, which is not traditionally a police matter. He pauses. You have to remember to pause. Nobody hears you when you rush. But the important thing isn't how long the Folly has been around. It's how it's changed. He doesn't get to go all the way through without questions, of course, but that wasn't the point. You want to control the course of the meeting, Grant had said. Thomas may or may not have rolled his eyes. Okay, fine, you knew that, but this gives it structure. They're going to be responding to you. I bet they don't have a set agenda. Oh, really? Thomas has said. I can imagine it. Apologies, introductions, epitaphs, end of meeting in time for lunch. That's not an agenda, Grant has said. That's a motivation. The mayor in particular is rather interested in the section on how much of London's population is likely to intersect with magic over their lifetimes. He wants to know where the data came from, and Thomas can point him at Beverly Brooke, who had spitballed estimates with Grant. She's not going to thank him for it, but she effectively volunteered. The Home Secretary makes faces when Thomas talks about the Soho Club, and the Russian diplomat Varvara had extricated in a half-hearted burst of patriotism. Apparently that hadn't made it through the right channels to be added to the tally of Thomas's sins. The Commissioner gets very thoughtful when Thomas explains about the county practitioner system that used to exist and the solutions, and, it had to be said, problems, it had offered. He hates to admit it, but Grant was right about the language. They poke right up at phrases like advisory group and community feedback. What you seem to be saying is that you don't necessarily envision everyone in your unit being a, says the Commissioner, practitioner? Everybody in our unit needs to be aware of and able to deal with magic, Thomas replies. That encompasses quite a wide range of people, many of whom are not practitioners. The Folly of the past, the main position was that practitioners of the art were the only bulwark against, to be quite honest, I'm not sure what anymore. But in general, it divided up the world we deal with into two groups, members of the Folly and everybody else. That goes fundamentally against the principles of policing. It has to change. It already is changing. She nods. He thinks he's scored a point. That was, the Home Secretary says when they wind to an end, not what I was led to expect from you, Inspector. I didn't put this together on my own, he says readily. The rest of the unit helped, including our civilian station manager. She's possibly the most technologically adept of us, actually. I thought she was, the Commissioner says and stops. About my age, says Thomas. Yes, she is. Hmm, the Commissioner says thoughtfully. The others do not ask questions, which Thomas is most grateful for. He doesn't really want to have to explain Molly in detail. There's only so much you can expect people to deal with. My question, says the Mayor, is why now? I knew it was timely for me to take on an apprentice 15 years ago, Thomas says. I couldn't find anybody. I knew it was past time 14 years ago after Berwick Street. I was refused permission before I even started looking. Is that true? The Mayor asks the Commissioner. A decision that predates my time, she says, but yes, I believe so. Well, says the Home Secretary, as I said, this is a very different picture than I expected. Your apprentices, says the Mayor. I take it you have full confidence in all of them. Entirely, says Thomas. No question about it. Gentlemen, says the Commissioner, do you think we could wrap this up? I have a lunch meeting. Despite saying this, she lingers a little after the others are gone. Do pass on my congratulations, she says, to the rest of the unit. Yes, she agrees, but also to Commander Grant for what I suspect was his considerable effort. I heard about the scene with Lady Tyburn, you see. I'm surprised the Mayor hadn't. Her mother did put her foot down, says Thomas. But yes, I'll pass that along. He was very helpful. That wasn't him talking, though, she says. That was all of you. You believe it? All those things you said? Is that so hard to believe, ma'am? Yes, as a matter of fact, she says. But you present all sorts of difficult things to believe, and yet I have to deal with them in the flesh. Of course you wouldn't be any different. Mom, Thomas says, not sure how to take that. What would you do with yourself, she asks, if you could step away one day? I don't know, Thomas tells her honestly, but I can see the possibility of needing to find out. Thomas was wondering if he'd see Grant around afterwards, but he leaves New Scotland Yard without incident, probably for the best. He should head right back to the Folly, let everyone know it went well. But he's sidetracked by a call from Thames Water, which it really seems best to handle himself. Or, not quite himself, but he gets there shortly before Walbrook does, and she seems happy to leave him to it for most part. Probably because even river goddesses like to be dressed for the occasion, and she's in a skirt suit, and her river is, to give it the most charitable possible description, principally underground. Thomas has once witnessed to a fellow police officer describing the Tyburn as basically a big sewer, in the presence of the goddess, when she was younger and rather more subject to impulse. The unsettling thing hadn't been how thoroughly she'd dealt with him, but that it had happened 2 months later. In hindsight, Thomas rather thinks a sign. He eats lunch on the run and arrives back at the Folly a little before 5 o'clock. He'd left a message with Molly that he was dealing with a minor case, but he doesn't get halfway down the back corridor after hanging up his coat before all four of his apprentices appear, almost stumbling over each other, so perhaps he could have been a little more reassuring. Afternoon, everybody, he says. Anything to report? He is the recipient of four of the most unimpressed looks he has ever seen on human faces. It's almost charming. No, says Abigail. How about you, sir? I had what I think can be described as a productive meeting, he says, the main upshot of which is that nobody needs to worry about going anywhere. Are you sure? Bursts out Matt. Yes, says Thomas, I'm quite sure. There's a sort of breathless pause while it sinks in, and then an outbreak of relieved smiles. Mal gives a cheer. Annie pats him on the arm awkwardly, grinning hugely, and then snatches her hand back like she's touched a hot stove. It's okay, you can give me a hug, Mal says, like she's offering a favour, and then looks startled when Annie does, squeezing so hard Mal gives a little oof, and then picks up Annie with one arm and twirls her around, only half leaning on her cane. Matt is slapping Abigail on the back, and smiling so hard it might break his face in half. Abigail throws an arm around his shoulders, a slightly difficult upwards trajectory, and pulls in the other girls too. They are all, for a second, uncomplicatedly happy. It's a good sight, Thomas thinks. A very good sight. We should go to the pub, says Abigail, as they pull apart. Sir, you're coming, right? Well, only if I want it, says Thomas. Oh, get your coat, Abigail orders, a little imperious, and for once, for the occasion, Thomas does as his apprentice says. They don't really have a local, or at least Thomas doesn't, his last having closed down in the 80s, and he himself having aged backwards too much for it somewhat before then. But the apprentices all seem to know where they're going, so he follows them. He'll have to make a note to avoid wherever it is unless asked in future. You have to let people have their space, and they all have to live with him. Abdul is already there, holding what looks like a ginger beer. He's talking to, of all people, Beverly Brooke. Thomas, because there are rules about these things, shouts all the apprentices their first round before he gets a chance to talk to him. It's still early enough, especially on a Monday, that the pub is still relatively empty. I hear I'm still going to be filling up all the MRI tech spare time for the foreseeable future, Abdul says. Not that you come in as often as you should. If I was going to fry my brain on the job, it would have happened by now, Thomas says, even though he's only at best half sure of that. I hear you made an impression, Beverly says. You're welcome, by the way. Thank you, says Thomas. He does know his manners. I'm told you helped. Were you told about the trade-off? Thomas, in point of fact, had not been. May I guess it has something to do with the, what was it called again? Independent advisory group? Good guess, says Beverly. I wouldn't really call that a trade-off, says Thomas. One or more of your sisters would have been part of it regardless. Just lucky for you that you get me then, Beverly says. Molly didn't want to come along. You know she doesn't need the Folly, says Thomas. You never know, says Beverly. Maybe one day. She stays long enough to finish her drink and chat with the apprentices. They all seem quite comfortable with her, particularly Abigail. But then she's almost, if not quite, old enough to count Beverly as a contemporary. What's an independent advisory group? Abdul wants to know once she's gone. They have them in all the boroughs, Annie offers before Thomas can get a word in. She's on the edge of the current conversation between the apprentices. to tell us when we're upsetting people, more or less. There are advisory groups at the corporate level too, says Thomas. Race relations, disability, LGBT, that sort of thing. And this would be the one for... Abdul gropes for the right word. The community you've got to deal with. That's the idea. Well, Abdul says, I can see how that would be useful. Or terrifying. Both, says Thomas, undoubtedly. Abdul has to get home to Finchley, and Thomas has just about finished his drink. The apprentices are chatting away and clearly won't mind or notice his absence. Abdul goes over to say goodbye to them, and Thomas is about to make his farewells too when a voice behind him says, I hear congratulations are in order. Can I buy you a pint to celebrate? Thomas turns around. It's Grant. He opens his mouth to say, Commander, then realises all of a sudden how profoundly inappropriate that would be, here, now, and says nothing. Or not. Not is fine. I just wanted to let you know I heard the good news. Say hi to the apprentices, Grant says gently, and Thomas finds his voice. I'll have a pint, if you're buying. Grant grins sunnily at him and goes to the bar, stops to say hi to the apprentices on the way there. He's not in uniform, but he's wearing a suit jacket. Thomas experiences a profound and sudden desire to see him dressed casually again, see what he looks like on the weekends, when he wakes up in the morning. Thank you, Peter, he says when Grant comes back with the drinks, having made up his mind to it. He was asked, after all those months ago. Grant grins again, the expression he accused Thomas of wearing too often, his eyes crinkling at the corners. And good God, how long has it been since Thomas was the cause of that sort of happiness in somebody else? Not in the abstract, but directly at him. It's an addictive feeling. Maybe that's how Grant, Peter, how Peter feels about it too. Thomas, he says, for only the second time, and they toast each other. They end up ordering food, settling in a little. The apprentices have drifted further away to a table of their own, have been joined by some others their own age. A young Asian woman with deep auburn hair, wearing a suit, has her arm around Mal's shoulders. And Thomas is reasonably certain he recognises Stephen McAllister Thames. He's definitely not going to ask. Who's Abigail's bloke? Asks Grant, who presumably doesn't know better. Looks familiar, but I can't remember why. Tyburn's eldest, says Thomas. Grant looks at least suitably worried. Oh, well, he says. Abigail knows what she's doing. Most of the time, Thomas says. I couldn't comment on it when it comes to that. Problem for another day, Grant concludes. In mutual but unspoken agreement, they don't talk about work. Instead, Grant ends up telling him about a childhood trip to Sierra Leone with his mother, and Thomas recounts the small amount of time he spent in West Africa, so very long ago now. My mother's been telling everybody that Abigail's a witch finder, Grant says. She seems to think it's much more respectable than being a police officer, and more impressive. I'm not sure Abigail's father feels the same way about it, but more people will listen to my mother anyway. That's, Thomas says, accurate from a certain perspective? Entirely accurate from her perspective, corrects Grant. I just can't believe she thinks it's more respectable than being a police officer. Naturally, says Thomas, that was definitely the perspective in my family. I don't believe you, Grant says, but he smiles as he shakes his head. They've come to a sort of natural pause in the evening. The apprentices are definitely past noticing whether Thomas is there or not, so he doesn't feel the need to make a point of farewelling them any more. So, says Grant. Come home with me, Thomas says, if you'd like to. We said maybe later a while back. I think that's now or not at all, which is also a reasonable answer. No, says Grant, says Peter. I mean, yes, I'd really like later to be now. Peter Grant kisses Thomas in Russell Square, quick, like a promise. It's the sort of stupid thing that might not be as unsafe as it once was, but still prickles across his skin, or maybe that's just the cooling autumn air. Third time's the charm, I hope, says Grant. Peter. The charm for what? Thomas has to ask. I don't know. Getting this right. Magic's no good for that, says Thomas, and takes him inside. I was this close to asking you out again a lot of times, if you hadn't guessed, Peter says, after kissing him again on the back doorstep. Magic's no good for this, but there's a certain kind of power to thresholds. I can't imagine what might have given that away, says Thomas, remembering all those times Grant, Peter, had not quite fallen into him. In Peter's flat, the night he'd come to the folly tired and worn around the edges. You didn't think it was worth the risk, I take it. Things were up in the air, he says. You, this, you know what I mean. I decided I couldn't help you and sleep with you. Might as well have handed Tyburn a stick to beat me with, us with. That's if you forgave me for not telling you everything. As if Thomas didn't know that. Seems to me like you were splitting hairs on the difference. Would have been a difference if I'd been asked directly. I don't know about you, says Peter. I'm a terrible liar. Ask anybody who knows me. I'm not sure I believe that, Thomas says. For one thing, there's no way you'd have survived past Sergeant. Are you accusing me of lying to senior officers? I think misleading senior officers about things they think senior officers don't need to know takes up at least half the brain power of the average junior officer. But do correct me if I'm wrong. Really, says Peter. Misleading is one thing, but ask me a direct question. The answer's all over my face. At least that's what Leslie's always claimed. And my mum. Maybe it's just Leslie and my mum. Well, I'm neither DCIMA nor your mother, Thomas feels obliged to point out. Go on then, Peter says. Ask me something. I'll show you. Can't lie to save my life. Like what? I don't know. Anything. Thomas doesn't bother with a question. Just steps in close and kisses him again. Peter doesn't even pretend to be surprised. Pulls him in close and kisses back like he's starving for it. His long, lean body pressed up against Thomas like he can get rid of their clothing through sheer willpower. Want to go to bed? Thomas asks when they come up for air. Like that's not why they came back here. God, yes, Peter murmurs. If you're lying, Thomas says, I certainly can't tell. Peter looks so outraged that he has to kiss him once more, and then that's the end of the conversation for a while. Grant doesn't hesitate to fall asleep in Thomas's bed, an act of trust in Thomas's book, and follows up by waking Thomas up the next morning in the best possible way. They have quiet, sleep-drenched morning sex of the sort Thomas hasn't had since he really can't remember when. He's never brought anybody back to the Folly before. In the rare event there's been anybody he could have brought, it never seemed like a good idea. Breakfast? Thomas asks before he heads into the shower. As I said once about dinner, there'll be plenty. Molly's probably already set you a place. You know what? Yeah, that'd be great. I have an 8 a.m. meeting and otherwise I have to scrounge something on the way to the office, Grant says. If you're okay with the rest of the household knowing I was here. As we've discussed, it takes 10 years to train a practitioner to full capacity, Thomas says, and like as not, they're going to be living here for most of that. So I'm not going to spend the next decade pretending not to have any sort of personal life. They're adults. I'm not convinced about Abigail, actually, Grant says, but okay. They're the first to the breakfast room. There is a spot for Grant, Thomas was right. And they're already eating when Annie appears. They've come to a compromise between Thomas's opinion that breakfast should be dressed for and the mores of the 21st century. Nobody wears what they wore to bed, but Annie's in track bottoms and a slightly ragged Free Scotland t-shirt, and her strawberry blonde hair is distinctly unbrushed. She frowns, recognises Grant, and stutters to a halt. Morning, Grant says cheerfully. Molly stole his suit overnight and pressed it. You'd need a critical eye to know he's wearing yesterday's clothes. Sir, Annie said. Good morning. Grant smiles and nods. Annie only spills a few drops of coffee when she pours. Thomas thinks she's doing rather well. Ah, says Abigail when she appears. She is, of course, somewhat more inured to the notion of Commander Peter Grant is a human being who eats breakfast than the rest of them. Very early meeting? Yes, Thomas ruthlessly purges himself. It's just not a topic he wants to even seem to imply about. It seemed rude to throw Commander Grant out without breakfast. Grant makes a slightly choked noise around a bite of toast. Thomas busies himself with his breakfast and pointedly does not observe his apprentice's expressions, although he can't help noticing that Mal's bad leg buckles as she enters the room and Matt has to save her from a nasty fall. He catches Grant's eye. Grant shrugs slightly, as if to say, "Told you so." Thomas tries not to smile, but ends up hiding it behind his cup. Overall, it's the quietest breakfast at the Folly since the apprentices showed up. Also, one of the nicest. Thomas does appreciate what the apprentices have done with the loft above the coach house, television included, but they're indulging in a rather raucous viewing of some show about home baking, and even if his presence wouldn't cast a pall on things, he doesn't have the energy. Molly seems to be enjoying herself when he poked his head in, however, which is really quite charming to see. He supposes he could always find a pub and watch the rugby, the opening matches of the World Cup are tonight. And then he wonders what Grant is up to. And then he wonders if Grant even likes watching rugby, which he probably doesn't. He calls anyway. What are you up to? Reading reports on my couch, the really glamorous part of my job. Actually, I was supposed to look at these last week, but you know what happened. You're welcome to come over and listen to me complain about how misleading all these graphs are. Do I have to sit on your couch? Because my mother brought me upright, guests get the armchair. I have to warn you, Grant. Peter, he reminds himself, says ruefully when he opens the door to his flat. I really do have to finish reading these tonight. On the other hand, I have Sky Sport and the beer in the fridge. Oh, is that so? Says Thomas. I hear there's some sort of rugby tournament on, Peter goes on. You probably don't care. Is there? I'm not sure I was aware of it. I only say this because Molly is furiously live-tweeting the Great British Bake Off, so I have a suspicion you're cut off from your own television, which I understand. Constables are one thing, but I wouldn't try competing with Molly. You knew exactly why I called you, Thomas accuses him. Peter just grins, like you mind. Thomas kisses him hello to show exactly how much he minds. He ends up on the couch anyway, which is just as uncomfortable as advertised, possibly more so with Peter's legs in his lap. He doesn't mind that much. They find the game on TV, and the commentary is punctuated in the slow parts by Peter waving a tablet in front of him and demanding he agree that a particular graft is really, totally unacceptable and a crime against the art of communication. Thomas nobly does his part by agreeing. They don't talk about anything to do with their jobs at all. The report Peter's reading isn't even from the Met, at least based on the headers. Even with at least two springs poking into him, Thomas feels himself relaxing. It's one of the nicest evenings he's had in a while. It's a relationship. He's not sure when that happened. How did that happen? Are we, he says out loud, not even sure he wants to. Are we, is this, he gestures helplessly between them. I don't know, says Peter, but you should definitely sleep with me at least a couple more times to make sure. Thomas pokes his foot. Since it's lying there all vulnerable and within reach, Peter yelps. You're going to have to put in slightly more effort than that, Thomas says. Good call, says Peter. Otherwise, do we really have to talk about it? No, Thomas replies immediately. Absolutely not. Great. Perfect. Let's not. Thomas pretends to pay attention to the game for a few minutes. We're okay DPS-wise, though, Peter adds eventually. If you were wondering, I was wondering. I just got this job, or it feels like I just did. I'd like to keep it for a while. What did you do? Ask them? God, no. I spent some quality time with their policy manual. Well, that sounds like fun. Honestly, says Peter, compared to what some of my colleagues are up to, I'm not even trying with you. But it's the Caesar's wife thing, you know. I'm not sure I take your meaning. Thomas has always hated classical metaphors. They're usually heavy-handed at best and poetic at worst. What was all that classical education for, then? Peter relents. Having a wife you barely see and a mistress on the side, preferably not one of your colleagues, but let's not pretend it doesn't happen, is normal. It goes along with acquiring a sudden passion for opera about the time you hit DCS. Now that I've never understood. Me neither, says Peter fervently. And yet, my point is, taking up with a male DCI has a whiff of scandal about it that the other doesn't, even these days. Not like when I was a constable or when you were... Were you ever a constable? No, Thomas has to admit. It was sort of a sideways career change. So best to plan ahead, Peter concludes. Make sure it's by the rules, in case somebody wants to make a fuss down the track. That sounds like an exhausting way to think about the world. Thomas has never liked politics of any sort, prefers to inhabit an own place. Yeah, but I don't have to chase people down or blow things up with my mind, so six of one, half a dozen of the other. I'll take the politics. It's less stressful, all else being equal. Let me guess. There's a study. I was generously not going to burden you with it. They toss back and forth the merits of holding various ranks for a few minutes. Thomas has spent almost his entire career at his current rank. Peter had a slow start and then an exponential rise. Strictly speaking, you should be a DCS, Peter muses. You're the head of an OCU, and it's not like seniority's a problem. But then again, you didn't have anybody to supervise for... Nearly forever, there, so there wouldn't have been much point. The principal use of rank, says Thomas, is to get people to pay attention when you speak, any higher, and I'd never get anything out of the people on the ground. I'm just saying we would have had a lot less trouble with Tyburn's whole attempt to uproot you if you'd been a DCS. That was one of the arguments she used, you know, with people who didn't know better. Peter shifts position a bit, probably avoiding a spring. Who knows? Keep acquiring people, maybe they'll bump you up eventually. That really isn't my goal, Thomas says, remembering that conversation with Tyburn. Oh well, says Peter. Still won't be an issue for about another 3 decades, the rate you're going. At which point he's likely to be retired, he doesn't say, and neither does Thomas. No point borrowing trouble. You do keep making my life more complicated, Thomas says instead, reaching for the remote. The game is over, and it's just the usual post-match blather. It was a game of 2 halves and so on. He rather feels for players these days. They never try to make them answer questions when it was just on the radio. As he switches the television off, Peter swings his legs off Thomas's lap and sits up. The couch makes a rather alarming noise. Thomas, Peter says, sober now. I've been trying to make your life easier, believe it or not. You are trying to make things right. That too, Peter allows. But seriously, after I got briefed, there's magic and river goddesses and all these other things, and people die. And all we put up against it is you on your own and try to pretend it doesn't matter and it doesn't affect the rest of us. Like the people who have to deal with it aren't part of this city too. It was fucking irresponsible. I couldn't let it go on like that. It doesn't matter that it was me on my own, Thomas says. Do you think it was better before the war? Do you think we practiced community policing? We said fey for everything we didn't understand, the same way the Greeks said barbarians. I gave up trying for more because I wasn't the person who could do something better than that. I didn't know where to start. I know, says Peter, but it's not unkind. So I thought I'd help you along, whether I wanted it or not. Peter shrugs. I thought I might be able to persuade you that you wanted it eventually. The innuendo clearly isn't intentional, but Thomas ducks his head and laughs all the same. Did you now? Thomas, Peter says again and puts a warm hand on his knee. Making this work is more important than anything else. So tell me if... Thomas looks up and Peter is biting his lip and something about this is heart-stopping, undeserved. What has he possibly done to have someone like Peter Grant looking at him like that? Consider me persuaded, Thomas says, and covers the hand with his own. Wizardry by Consent by Sixth Light. Chapter 5. Epilogue. A Fork in the Road. I was thinking about it, Peter says one day in October, when they're walking back to the Folly through Russell Square. He wants to look at the county practitioner records. Thomas isn't sure what the outcome of this will be, but is perhaps almost looking forward to finding out. Thinking about what? You said you tried to find apprentices a few years back. I wonder what would have happened if you tried with me. You were busy rising meteorically, says Thomas. I don't think you'd have been tempted. No, but see, Peter says, I got things together fast enough, but there was this point. I did my probation. I wanted CID, and they sent me to the case progression unit. Leslie got assigned to the murder squad, plain clothes. I just about died of jealousy. I thought my career was over before it started. They were setting you up for management, Thomas says. He's seen how the system works. They wanted you to be thinking about how cases are run, how all the pieces fit together. Playing to Peter's skills. Look where he'd ended up. I know that now, but then, I mean it. I thought I was doomed to paperwork forevermore. Well, I wasn't wrong, but it gets more interesting the higher you get. Also, it gets easier to delegate it to other people. That too, Peter grins. What I'm saying is, if you'd asked me, back then, those first few months, before I got pulled into a CSU, offered to teach me magic, I'd have said yes, no question, so fast your head would have spun, and then what would have happened? Thomas contemplates the prospect of Peter Grant as he must have been as a constable, ambitious in an unassuming way, frighteningly intelligent, maybe less confident than he is now, but still that solid determination under it all. I imagine you would have learned magic. I imagine I would have driven you absolutely bonkers, Peter says cheerfully, even if you'd had the ability to tell me to just shut up. Not that you'd say it like that. I think I would have survived, but it would have been frustrating for you, I think. There wouldn't have been anywhere for you to go. Immortus senior officers are a problem in that regard, Peter concedes. Still, I don't know. It's an interesting thought. The world might have been better, is what Thomas thinks, if it had Peter sooner. Peter's vision, Peter's certainty, Peter's drive to learn. What ifs, though, they don't help. They never have. I'd have liked that, he says instead, driven bonkers or not. But I think I like you where you are, too. Yeah, Commander Peter Grant says as they mount the steps of the Folly. Me too. The end. Author's notes. Thank you to everybody who has read, kudosed or commented while this has been going up. I talked in the notes of changes of perspective about the two types of AU. This is mostly type A. What would have happened if? The if in this case being, if Peter Grant had joined the case progression unit and never learned about magic. It wasn't meant to be, but the plot happened to me. Oops. The OC apprentices in this story, Matt, Mal and Annie, are all borrowed from my post-canonish Future Fix series. I like them too much to invent new ones or just stick with Abigail. I did do some research into the organisation and structure of the Metropolitan Police Service, as well as their policy on community engagement, for the purpose of making Peter sound vaguely like he knew what he was on about. But A, this is set 10 years in the future from the present, hence all the hints about the fallout of Brexit, and B, I didn't do that much research, so please excuse any unintentional errors. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to leave kudos or comments for the author of this story, please go to Sixth Light page on AO3. It'll be linked from where you downloaded this podfic from. If you'd like to leave kudos or comments to the reader, me, Lazulus, then you can also go to AO3 and leave them there. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story.